Good afternoon, Michael.
Afternoon, Mark.
How are you?
Oh, pretty good. How about you?
Very good. You're one floor below me.
Yeah, it's fun to be back on Blogging Heads. Somebody described this to me earlier as Wayne's World for Wonks.
Yeah, well, that's good. You've done it once before, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Last time I did it with Rosa Brooks, who was actually working out of my old office at Open Society Institute in New York, or not exactly my office, and now I'm doing it with somebody in my office. So it's an incestuous Wayne's World for Wonks.
Well, but you're moving to Washington. Back in the 80s, Irving Kristol said everything was leaving New York and moving to Washington, so I guess you kind of illustrate that.
I know, the new intellectual capital. I try to remind, even though there's not much about Irving Kristol that I really latch onto, but I try to remind myself of that every time I hate living in Washington. I don't think he was right. Anyway, so you had a great article in the Financial Times yesterday, which,
well, thanks.
I admitted, I felt like I'd read the Financial Times very thoroughly on the subway yesterday morning. And then you mentioned this article to me, and I realized somehow I had completely missed it.
Well, it was easy to overlook my op-ed. It was at the top of the op-ed page.
I know. You viewed you mentioned that it might have been evidence of a deep-seated hostility, and I couldn't really disprove that because
that's
it was actually
you and your
very
therapist.
Prominently placed. I think it was the victim of my obsession with reading everything there is to read about the French election.
Well, that's because my article was right over the Sarkozy cartoon, so
right.
People went straight for the cartoon.
Anyway, but then I after that, of course, I did read it, and I thought it was fascinating. And why don't you kind of say a few words about what your argument there was, and then we can talk about it a little bit.
Well, the point was when I developed in greater length in my new book, The American Way of Strategy, that will be my first and last flog on this blog, that in the Cold War there were two distinct foreign policy traditions, even among hawks. There was a sort of Republican tradition of Eisenhower and Nixon, and it was very tough and anti-communist, but because the Republicans then were the party of capital, the party of business, they were very averse to enormously high defense budgets, unlike the Democrats, beginning with the Gaither Commission report under Truman, who were much willing to spend more money on both domestic welfare and on foreign policy. And so I argue that there is a distinctive old-fashioned, you know, maybe Rockefeller Republican way of war that you can identify in Eisenhower and Nixon and Colin Powell, and to some extent in Reagan. Reagan was sort of a mix of Cold War Democrats and Cold War Republicans. Eisenhower worried about the military-industrial complex draining too much from the civilian economy. And so rather than have a vast conventional army to defeat the Soviets, he wanted to concentrate on air power and atomic strikes. And then Nixon, while extricating us from Vietnam, came up with the Nixon Doctrine, which was that our allies should provide most of the manpower for their own defense, an obvious response to the Vietnam War, where we were fighting on behalf of various incompetent regimes in South Vietnam. And then you have the Powell Doctrine, which is that the U.S. should not send the military except as a very last resort. And into that mix I throw the Reagan Doctrine, not in terms of Reagan's whole foreign policy, which was quite complicated. Some of it can be very harshly criticized. But the idea of freedom fighters, that is, if you want to liberate your country like the Afghan rebels, we'll give you arms, we'll give you intelligence, lawyers, guns, and money. But we're not going to go liberate it for you while you sit by and watch.
Right, unless it's a country, unless it's small enough that we could do it in 3 days.
Yeah, you know, like a Grenada or something.
Grenada,
like that.
Yeah.
Or even Panama. And so I think a lot of people, it's gotten a lot of response. It's crystallized a disquiet, I think, with George W. Bush, both as a manager. He's the very opposite of Eisenhower. Eisenhower would have a council of war. He would carefully listen to all of the different sides. He would reflect on everything. He wasn't at all impulsive and intuitive and stubborn like this president. But also, I have to say, as a former Cold War Democrat, it expresses some of my disquiet with the fact that the neocons did come, let's face it, they did come out of the Cold War wing of the Democratic Party.
Right.
And you can see them as sort of a horrible mutation of it, but the DNA is, you know, it really is the Truman, Kennedy, Johnson Democrats, who were much more willing to spend both money and blood than the Eisenhower-Nixon types.
But doesn't Rumsfeld come out of that Eisenhower-Nixon tradition in that, you know, he wanted to do kind of revolution in military affairs stuff, which is really, you know, similar, the idea that you can, you know, do a lot with technology?
Yeah, he did. And a few years ago, the only piece I've ever wrote in favor of the Bush administration, it was praising Rumsfeld's transformation ideas. The thing about transformation, that makes perfect sense, and it's inevitable in the long run, if you're talking about state-to-state warfare. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking about our Air Force smashing their Air Force, well, having our Air Force made up of robot drones, mm-hmm. You know, with satellite guidance, you know, it makes it... And actually, it fits into this logic. You're sparing human beings. You're sparing your soldiers and sending your machines against the other side. Mm-hmm. The tragedy of Rumsfeld and also of Andrew Marshall, who's one of the neocon theorists of the Revolution in Military Affairs, was that the mission that Bush chose for them, with Rumsfeld's support, evidently, is the one where our advantage in technology and in capital is completely irrelevant. That's suppressing right. insurgents.
Right, right, right. Right. So, in a sense, you've got the an almost sick and naive extreme. Not sick, you've got a sort of naive extreme of the Eisenhower wing that really believes, you know, which is similar to the people who believe you could just, you know, knock out everything in Iran in 3 days of bombing and move on. You've got that wing, which is not a neocon wing, meets the neocon sort of hyper idealism. It creates a sort of nasty stew, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you see this kind of compound or nasty stew, this toxic compound. Mm-hmm. It goes back to the Reagan administration because Reagan presided over this coalition of the old Eisenhower-Nixon hawks, plus the neocons, you know, who had deserted the Democratic Party. And many of them at that time were still Democrats. Some of them, like Sidney Hooker, even socialists. Right. And Reagan sort of threaded his way between them, and he kept both sides happy, basically by giving them what they wanted.
Right.
And so he gave the neocons, which, just to back up a little bit, see, the big criticism of the Eisenhower strategy came from Democrats in the late 50s and early 1960s, who said, we have to be prepared to fight a limited conventional war with right. the Soviet Union that would go right. on for months and months and months and months. Well, so that critique led to this buildup of the U.S. conventional military and NATO, and many of those forces that were ultimately destined for NATO ended up fighting in Vietnam, where you were using right. conventional forces to chase guerrillas. The same thing happened in the 1990s. It's sort of a very disturbing parallel to Vietnam, because the hawks built up these, the neocons wanted to build up these conventional forces basically to fight China. Or Iran, you know, or Russia, you know, a conventional great power or semi-great power. And instead they were assigned, again, you know, to chase guerrillas and insurgents right. in unpromising conditions.
Right.
You know, and we see this right now with the U.S. defense budget. If you include all of the black programs and all of the off-budget stuff, technically it's 4% of GDP, but it's probably more than 5%, even higher than that, you're getting mm-hmm. close to 6%. Which was the height of the Second Cold War under Reagan, and it was pretty close right. to the overall Cold War average.
Right.
Now, none of that money, or very little of that money, is being used against al-Qaeda.
Right.
You know, it's essentially to build up a navy that can sink the Chinese navy,
right.
you know, and that can bomb Russia or Iran back into the Stone Age. Right. So this has been sold to the public as being used against terrorism, but, you know, you don't use aircraft carriers, apart from the occasional missile strike, to go after jihadists, you know, living in cities in Pakistan or in, you know, hotels right. in Britain.
Right, right.
Well, and I do think it 6%, it may not sound like a lot, but the French, who are the most hawkish Europeans, until recently spent like 2.83% of GDP. That we were at 3% of GDP under Clinton.
Right. Well, we are protecting a lot of other countries.
Well, that's right. But if those countries themselves have been slashing their defense budgets the way the Europeans have been doing, then what exactly is the threat that we're protecting them from? Because they had very high defense budgets during
right.
the Cold War. Right. You know, this number about how the United States has outspends our NATO allies combined, mm-hmm. that's only since the end of the Cold War, because during the Cold War, the Europeans spent a great deal on their own defense in addition to what we provided.
Right.
So
right.
it looks increasingly to me, and I'm, you know, sort of an instinctive hawk, that we have a real problem of threat inflation on the one hand, mm-hmm. inflating the possible conventional war threat from China in particular, which is extremely unlikely.
Right.
And then there's a sort of bait and switch, whereby all of these expensive long-term legacy military programs that are really designed to fight other great powers mm-hmm. are being bought in the name of fighting Al-Qaeda and the jihadists.
Right. Right. But it's not like you would build up massive numbers of people of actual troops to fight the jihadists either.
Well,
right.
Yes and no. You know, well,
to fight Al-Qaeda, I don't like. I mean,
if you were
plenty
going,
of jihadists are not our
yeah.
problem.
No. But if you were trying to pacify Iraq, then you would want more troops on the ground. They would be trained
right.
and disposed differently.
Right.
But you would want a greater number because the experience of Northern Ireland, for example, I don't know what the exact number is, but if you take that proportion of troops to the civilian occupation and transfer it to Iraq, you would want 400,000, 500,000 or more troops on the ground for 10 or 20 years. Well, obviously, the public's turned against this.
Right, right.
You know, I think it's kind of, it might be tactically clever, but it's strategically unwise for the Democrats to make a big deal about, you know, some of them say, well, we want to increase the number of American troops overall worldwide. Because the truth is, if you're pulling out of Iraq in the next couple of years, and you're not planning to invade and occupy another country, we've got all the troops we need.
Right. That's right. Well, yes. Yes, although plenty of people will, I guess, have to, it's strained in many ways.
Yeah, if the operational tempo has been very high, not just since the Iraq War began, but since the Cold War. I mean, since the Cold War ended in the mm-hmm. 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
But this goes back to the late 1970s because the service chiefs set up this system whereby you wouldn't be able to deploy troops beyond a certain point without calling up the reserves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because it was part of this post-Vietnam War backlash within the military. And this is the thinking that shaped the Powell Doctrine, you know, we shouldn't go to war unless the American people
right.
are behind us. So they created this kind of tripwire where if you had any substantial war at all, you would begin calling all these National Guard units up. And then the military thought deep down this would force a national debate about
right.
the war.
Right.
And we're seeing the fruition of this now.
Right. But national debate 3 years after the war started.
Yeah.
Well, you had, because Rumsfeld had his delusions. I mean, I don't know. I mean, was it a total lie, or do you think that there was actually a belief that you could do it all with special forces and technology and that when Shinseki said you'll need 100,000 or 200, you know, when Shinseki said whatever number got him fired, did they really believe that?
Yeah, no, I think they were completely.
They
were completely sincere. I have no doubt about that. But remember, what they didn't even see it as a military problem because they thought there would be a political solution.
Right.
Right. You would have Ahmed Chalabi, or someone would become America's man in Baghdad, and you would have a new government. It would be like Panama after Noriega was removed.
Right. Right.
So I don't think they even considered the possibility
right.
of a prolonged insurgency.
Right.
So in a way, accusing them of incompetence for not having the right plan to deal with the insurgency, I think lets them get off too lightly. They didn't even foresee the possibility of a prolonged insurgency.
Right, right. So, but in a sense, that vision, that Rumsfeld vision, which is in the Eisenhower tradition, is now so discredited that, of course, it's a natural thing for an Obama, for the Democratic candidates, to sort of see the solution as go in the direction, you know, admit that you can't do it with technology and special forces alone, right? And
therefore, you do need
an increase in troops.
What is it? What you can do with technology is smash other states.
Point. What is it? Right, right.
And so the Democrats, if they're smart, will embrace this. Because we're in the middle of it. There really is a revolution in military affairs, to use the jargon.
Mm-hmm.
The manned fighter aircraft is going to give way to drones. Most of our naval surface and surface fleet will be robots in 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that we do need to invest in that.
Right.
Whoever is president. So the real question is, do you send U.S. troops to engage in these peacemaking or peace-imposing efforts? It's different from peacekeeping.
Right.
You know, peacekeeping we've done fairly successfully, where there's a peace to be kept, you know, where you're
mm-hmm.
enforcing something. Where you're trying to impose order on chaos by force, that
mm-hmm.
really is more like classical colonial occupation.
Right.
I wouldn't say that Rumsfeld has been discredited at the revolution in military affairs. It's simply irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do it with that particular set of tools. Right. You want to have the high-tech transformation to deter other great powers and other regional powers who might think about conventional assaults. So it's essentially useful for deterrence.
Right.
But, you know, you don't go after ants with a hammer. You know,
But we are, I mean, you're also saying that we're not going to have a great powers war, a great power war with China, let's say. I mean, aren't we more likely to face, I mean, there don't have to be Iraq is a situation of our own making. It's our fault.
Right.
But there are going to be other situations, especially those who have a more humanitarian view, there are going to be other situations where we are going actually to want to impose, whether, you know, whether it's Darfur or something else, where we are actually going to want to try to impose some peace on a situation. Isn't that more likely to be the foreign policy situation we'll wind up in, even if we're sparing about how often we do that?
Well, who is we? That's the first question, because I think that, you know, you can talk about Darfur all you want. I doubt very seriously that the next president, even a Democrat, is going to send tens or hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops into Darfur,
mm-hmm.
you know, as after the Iraq War, because of the political backlash about this.
Because of the political backlash after the Gulf, after the Iraq War,
exactly.
Which is to say the Iraq War makes us unable to engage in situations which we might otherwise want to engage in.
Yeah, I think it's a tragedy because you want to have specially trained U.S. constabulary forces that are trained in sort of policing paramilitary peacekeeping instead of kicking down doors, you know, and you know, shooting wildly into the night. You
right.
want to have U.S. constabulary forces who can work along with NATO and EU and UN blue helmets in mm-hmm. various parts around the world. It seems to me that should be part of our repertoire militarily.
Right.
I think politically, Bush has inadvertently destroyed that option, possibly, for a decade or so.
Right.
Simply because anything will be seen as an Iraq-like quagmire, even things that make sense.
Right. That's right.
But in terms of your earlier point about the conventional war, my own view is that the lesson of the Cold War is, if you're going to fight a Cold War, fight a Cold War. And this gets back to Eisenhower. You don't spend most of your military, if you think you're going to be engaged in arms races and also in proxy battles in third world countries with your enemy, but you're never going to have direct homeland-to-homeland conflict,
mm-hmm.
don't spend your budget on World War II-type armies and
right.
expecting World War II, War in the Pacific-type naval battles.
Right.
It's a waste of money.
Right.
It's a waste of money. So I think that conventional direct wars between the U.S., China, you know, other major powers are extremely unlikely mm-hmm. in our lifetimes. Cold wars are quite possible,
mm-hmm.
where there would be nuclear arms races, you know, anti-satellite arms races at the high end mm-hmm. of the conflict spectrum. And then at the low end, you know, there would be a civil war in some oil-producing country
mm-hmm.
with one side that arming one and the other, and us arming the other side.
Right.
But what that means is you need advisors at the low end and these sort of constabulary troops.
Right.
And at the high end, you know, you're going to have a deterrence, you
right.
know, which will mostly be a high-tech deterrent. Now, this is a huge crisis for the services because
right.
it means that the role, the traditional role of the U.S. Army, it's not quite sure that it has a role in this new world, in a
right.
world of Cold War competitions.
Right.
And the Navy is struggling to adapt. I've been taking part in some consultations about their new maritime strategy. They're trying to have a fresh look at, you know, what is the role of the Navy in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
But all of this is being revolutionized by technology very clearly. And the instinct of the services is to assume you have your traditional warfare only with new gizmos, right?
Right.
You know, and this is something you saw in the 1950s where the Army was tasked by the Eisenhower administration and others with coming up with a plan for integrating nuclear weapons into warfare.
Right.
So among the silly ideas they came up with was, you know, giving individual soldiers atomic bomb bazookas.
But I came up with that idea in fourth grade. I think it was a really great idea. I think I melted some guys, some of those green guys, those plastic guys.
You know, but this also threatens things. Like, you see this in the whole gaze in the military debate. If you end up with a military that is largely technicians and bunkers on the one hand,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, sort of Bratton, you know, Giuliani-type police forces on the other, then this whole hierarchical, you know, conservative, European-style military subculture, however effective that was in the 19th and 20th centuries, you have to wonder, maybe this was just a blip in history.
Right, right.
You know, why do you have to live on base, you know? Why do you have to have a separate subculture? Why can't you drive back and forth to the office if you're doing all this over computers from long distance?
Right.
You know,
or just be like
a policeman or a fireman.
Right. Well, and once you bring in all the reservists, you actually have more of that culture, right, of people who already are not living on the base and aren't used to that culture. You know, this reminds me of, let me see if you have anything to say about this interesting question, because this kind of brings it around to U.S. politics. You mentioned, you know, Giuliani-Bratton-type policing, and clearly that's, you know, kind of the model for what you want to do with a, you know, with both dealing with Al-Qaeda and dealing, you know, if you had a more manageable situation in Iraq, that's the kind of thing you'd want to do. It seems to me interesting, like, the conservative line, the conservative attack on liberals is, you people think terrorism is some kind of law enforcement problem. We know it's a military problem. And then you have Giuliani, who is clearly, like, the war on terror candidate, saying, you know, and his credibility beyond what he did on September 11th, which was, you know, not act like a bozo, his credibility is based on reducing crime in New York, and which is clearly a law enforcement strategy, and in many ways, actually a kind of a soft law enforcement strategy. I mean, it was the massive database that they developed, so they kind of knew what was going on, and it was community policing, which meant, you know, you kind of got into the community and you kind of knew what was going on, and you knew who was who, and you weren't always just responding to the 911 call. You were actually visible on the street, and you were in touch with people. It wasn't purely lock 'em up strategy. I mean, there was a certain amount of lock 'em up.
That's exactly right, and in fact, it's even more indirect than that for the U.S. because we're not the ones who will do the community policing.
Right.
You know, we send our guys to train the locals.
Right. Yeah.
But it's not going to be a bunch of guys from South Carolina and Maine and California doing this. You know,
right,
it's going to be the Pakistanis and Waziristanis.
Right, right. I mean, in a sense, there is a certain amount of soft power element to training people to understand their communities and figure, you know, be in a position that you actually find out who's cooking up some plot or something like that.
Well, I think this whole war narrative, as opposed to law enforcement, is completely wrongheaded. But as an American, I understand it, because we're basically a civilian country, right? And we don't have a long colonial tradition, apart from a few, you know, Caribbean interventions in the Philippines and so on, unlike the British and the French.
Right.
And so as a civilian society, we want to have peace. And then if there's a war, we want there to be a short war. We use our military-industrial capability to flatten the enemy, to spare as many American soldiers as possible. At the expense, maybe, of the foreigners.
Right.
And then it's over.
Right. And you win. And that's where the narrative of you win or you lose. Those people are against victory. They don't want those defeatocrats. They're not willing. What did Bush say about the Baker-Hamilton plan? There's nothing in here about victory.
Yeah, and so it's a completely misguided approach to the problem. Right. But on the other hand, it's rooted in admirable aspects of American character that I, for one, wouldn't want to see change that much. I mean, it's just a very difficult situation. But as I say, at the end of the day, you know, if we're going to be a great power, you can't pick and choose your interventions. You know, the crises are thrust upon you sometimes. And we're going to have some skin in the game by sending our own constabulary forces to some of these multinational interventions.
But that
means these can be prolonged things. They're more like law enforcement. You know, like Bosnia. They go on for year after year. There's no victory at the end. And if American conservative culture can't deal with it, then the culture is just going to have to change, or they're going to be irrelevant in the military realm.
Right, right. But, I mean, actually, your vision is it's a sort of optimistic one, partly because it says, you know, we can actually afford to do this. I mean, you have a smaller force, which is largely constabulary. I don't think I've ever used that word before in my life. You have a smaller constabulary force. You don't actually have all the high-tech weapons. And you're actually going to be able, if you can deal with the services, right, and their issues, and be imaginative about this, you could actually spend far less.
Yeah, that's right. You need to spend a great deal of money at the high end.
Right.
You know, not only on nuclear deterrence and conventional deterrence, but also on power projection capabilities. Right now we're unrivaled, and we have to be, because we're on an island far away from all the other centers of world power. So in order to get there, we have to project power across the oceans.
But that's aircraft
airlift
carriers,
and,
right?
I mean, yeah, airlift and sea lift and aircraft carriers. No, but it's true. Manpower is the single most expensive aspect of the military, and you could have a much smaller military that's more geared towards these constabulary interventions. And that doesn't mean you don't go to war against mass armies of rogue states, but it means that you lead a coalition so that the manpower is provided largely by allies, you know, from countries that are immediately affected by these countries. You don't just do it while they sit by on the watch and either cheer or jeer from the sidelines. Look, and this gets to the budget issues, too. And again, I've got a record as a Cold War hawk. The truth is there's no reason why the U.S., after Iraq, should be spending 5-6% of GDP on defense. We could get by perfectly well with 3%, probably with 2% of GDP, and without skimping on anything we would need in a real crisis. This is never raised in all of these budget hawk concerns about Social Security and Medicare. You know, they'll say, if we don't slash middle-class benefits right now in Social Security and Medicare and inflict all this pain on middle-class people, then the unthinkable will happen. We'll have to either raise taxes by 2% by the year 2037 or whatever, or we'll have to cut spending by 2%. Well, let's say we're spending 6% of GDP on defense. There's 2% right there.
Well, that's right. That's right.
Right there.
Yeah.
Now, I guess this puts me on the far left now, you know, because I'm saying cut the military to pay for expansion of Social Security and Medicare.
Right.
But you and I know this is going to happen.
Right.
It's going to happen.
Well, you make the military choices independently. I mean, you're not doing it because you're saying military is a lower priority. I mean, you can maintain your sense of priorities, but if you do the military work right and you understand the threats in the way that, you know, you do better than I do, and you made a great case here for it, you can do that totally separately. I mean, it does become sort of like, you know, the peace dividend if you know what you're doing on this side. And then, in fact, you know, I mean, I've gone from, I mean, 3 or 4 months ago I wrote an article basically arguing that we were going to need to get ready for the big tax increase, and now, and I still think we need to be able to confront, we're going to need to raise taxes, but not just to maintain what we've already got. We, you know, if we want government to do more, if we're ready to take on health care, obviously we're going to need to finance that. More of that cost is going to be public, even if the total spending on health care may be less. More of it's going to be public. We'll need to deal with taxes. But I'm really kind of softening up when you know the deficit that we're running. You know, that deficit number keeps going down to I think it's to about 200 billion now, entirely within manageable ranges, and well, I'm sort of coming around to that view. And you know, the entitlement, what they call an entitlement crisis, what you have to cut Social Security, you have to cut Medicare. What we have is a health care crisis. And well, if you know, the health care costs under control, you don't have an entitlement crisis anymore.
Well, the other thing, I'm sort of a wild optimist on the long term U.S. and world economy, because I think we're on the verge of the next industrial revolution, and this is going to be a real industrial revolution in real-world physical materials and manufacturing and so on. What we called the third industrial revolution of the 80s and 90s, you know, it was essentially a telecom, you know, revolution.
Right.
It was a transformative communications technology like the telegraph and like the telephone, and that you know, increased productivity. But to have a real transformative industrial revolution, it's how things are actually made.
Right.
And what they're made of,
right.
You know, and we have various exotic technologies coming down the line, photonics, which allows you to have packets of light transmitting information far more rapidly than electrical signals in copper wire. If we shift to photonics, and that's just an example, we're going to tear up all of the copper wire in the world and lay down glass cable.
Right.
It's going to be this enormous
Didn't a lot of that happen?
Yeah.
Didn't already a lot of that happen in the late 90s?
Yeah, there's a lot of dark cable.
About 3% of it is being used.
Yeah. And there's a lot of so-called dark cable out there.
Right, right. All owned by Global Crossing.
One of the subjects I've been following for a couple of years with my friend James Pinkerton, we call it Page 34 News, because it's always on Page 34, even though it's going to be the most important thing in the, you know, like, for a century, desktop manufacturing.
Right.
And finally, this made it into the New York Times,
right,
to their editorial page the other day. And this is rapidly advancing. And you know, Alvin and Heidi Toffler talked about the demassification of production back in the 60s, and then it didn't happen in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and people honestly, oh, well, it's just, you know, another one of those utopian dreams.
Right.
This is going to transform how things are made.
That's right.
You know, when you can essentially have raw materials, and then people can do things in small businesses and even at home in garages, mm-hmm. that right now it would take, you know, some $100 million factory to do.
Right, right.
And it changes everything, because if you don't have these long production runs, then you don't have to have the guaranteed giant markets. You don't have to have the mass advertising. It's going to transform all of our debates about international trade.
Right, right,
you know,
right.
Because right now we're extrapolating the last decade. So we think, well, what will happen is you will have these cheap labor countries will suck away the manufacturing from all the advanced industrial countries, you know, for the next 100 years.
Right.
Who knows? Who knows what will happen?
Right, right.
One thing I'm confident of, this is going to set off such a huge global boom. And the other reason to be optimistic about the global economy is it can no longer be screwed up by one or two centers anymore.
Right.
Because, right. you know, in the old days, if the U.S. sneezed, then the whole world caught a cold, right?
Right.
Right now, Asia has surpassed the U.S. as the center of world manufacturing.
Right.
Europe is roughly equal to the U.S. in terms of global GDP. And you even have the so-called BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, coming up, catching mm-hmm. up. So that means if the U.S. sinks for a while, it doesn't necessarily matter
right.
if Europe and China and other countries are booming.
Right. Now, our colleague Barry Lynn has some interesting points about the way we now structure manufacturing, where it's so many pieces of the process are so centralized. There's, you know, there's one plant that makes all of this
right.
particular, you know, material for computer chips or something like that, you know, that's in Singapore or something like that, because of the enormous, you know, grinding drive for efficiency.
There's a lot of places that
if they sneeze, you have problems.
Well, his concern about the fragility of supply chains, I think, is legitimate. But my suspicion is, and this may take 20, 30, you know, 50 years, that the evolution of manufacturing capability is simply going to eliminate a lot of these supply chain problems, because you're going to have one factory doing lots of different things.
That's right, right.
You know, and at that point, the other thing is most international trade goes by ship now, and that's not going to be affected that much by rising energy prices. But to a certain extent, there's a point at which rising energy prices mean the cost of shipping a good, you know, from the U.S. to Indonesia and then back to Mexico to take advantage of prevailing local wages simply the benefit is outweighed by the cost. I mean, it's an incredible kind of Rube Goldberg scheme.
Right.
So I think it may just turn out to be another historical blip.
Right. Well, I think I think the situation we're in now is one where if the information is widely distributed, and intellectual capacity is widely distributed. So lots of people can design a computer chip, for example, on a regular computer, and you could do something really innovative. But almost nobody has the capacity to actually manufacture that. You're going to go outside. Even huge firms don't have the physical capacity to actually they don't own a fab, you know, is the saying, I guess. And I remember a quote from one of these like old chip guys, I think it's in Barry's book, where he's like, real men own fabs. Well, real men don't own fabs anymore. They do the thing on the computer, they send it to Hong Kong because there's one place in Hong Kong that can make this chip for you, and then it'll come back to you.
Yeah, but look at what happens.
Once that second capacity to actually make the thing is widely distributed, and I think it is really a potentially an amazing revolution, then you move into a new era, and the era we're in now is where one side of the equation is widely distributed and the other side is tightly controlled.
I think that's exactly right. I think the parallel may be found in the evolution of desktop publishing, because you didn't go immediately from the giant publishers, you know, who tended to farm out this work either to low-wage areas in the United States, the actual manufacturer of a book, or even abroad in some cases. There was an intermediate step, and it was Kinko's Copies, remember?
I do remember.
You know, in the 80s and 90s. You know, you would take in your computer disk, and then they would print it out.
Right.
You can now do this at home.
Right.
With your home printer. So it may take a while, but I think the next step will be you're going to have these fabs, you know, these fabricators. They may not be personal. It may still be too expensive for that. But you'll be able to come up with the design for what you want to create. And then you can take it to the local village, you know, factory, which will be able to do various different things. So unlike your traditional 19th, 20th century factory, where you can only do Ford Model Ts, and there's a vast capital investment, you'll be able to do what you can do now with architectural modeling and increasingly with toys and various other things. Just feed in the program, and as long as you have the raw materials and the appropriate computer manufacturing technology, you can make different devices. And potentially, and again, this is sort of science fiction-like, but you can see a shift back to the craftsman, artisan economy, because before you had mass production, you had the village blacksmith, right? And you go to the village blacksmith and say, okay, I want a horseshoe and a skillet, you know, and a ring. Right. And then he would make them, right? And with mass production, you have separate factories, each one of which, to make a profit, has to put out 1,000 of those a day.
Right. See, that's what I mean, I don't know, and we have another colleague, Phil Longman, has written and talked about this a lot recently as well. And I think that's where it sort of loses me, because I think there's a focus on, you know, making this thing for yourself, like getting this thing that's just for you. You know, and Phil made the analogy to blogging, and for example, and I think that that's a lot of the things that we do on the sort of information side. Yeah, you're doing it for, you're doing things on your own that you used to need a whole structure to do. You used to need a, you know, in order to have a newspaper column that reached, you know, several thousands of people, you needed all the infrastructure of a newspaper that went with it, and you don't need those things now. On the other hand, what you're still part of, you know, a sort of vast interdependent, in a sense, what there is room for, it's not like you're doing it for yourself. What you're doing is you're finding your specialty in a hugely complicated network that's not necessarily structured as a firm.
Well, what you find is, I agree with you. I think the main impact of this will be, we will still have a commercial society with a division of labor. I mean, it's not that everyone's going to be making everything at home like yeoman farmers making their own soap or something like that.
Which was Phil's analogy.
Yeah, but I think what it does is it lowers the barrier to entry for small firms.
Right.
To get into things that, I mean, think about like the big three, right? You know, the seven sisters. I mean, in the early industrial era, the costs of investment were so huge. And it's the same thing you've seen with the indie, you know, films, you know, versus Hollywood studios.
Right.
So I think what it immediately liberates is small producers. But I'm sort of skeptical. For one thing, there's the time factor. I mean, you'll have hobbyists who spend lots of time, you know, making their own spaceships in the garage or whatever. But for the most part, you will buy your little personal helicopter.
Right.
But it may be from somebody down the street, you know, instead of from somebody in China, one of the three big personal helicopter corporations of the world.
Right. I want my jetpack. I still want my jetpack. The future that was promised me when I was young has not arrived.
Well, James Fallows, you know, his book Free Flight was lauding NASA's effort at an interstate skyway system. But, of course, you know, I think about this now that I live in downtown Washington, where since the war began, helicopters are constantly orbiting overhead. And it's a ceaseless drone, and I think, do I really want the sky filled with a dark cloud of buzzing FedEx robot drones? You know, all rushing back.
No, you don't. Well, if they just make them a little quieter. If the jetpack were quiet, it would be great. Zip home, be fabulous. We'd get no exercise. So this is, you know, if we could be sure about the long-term future, we could be a lot more optimistic about the short-term future.
Well, we wouldn't be wonks. We would be, we would be billionaires.
We
could be sure about the future.
Right.
But I do think that it's a terrible mistake for politicians to talk about government in terms of just dollars.
Right.
Just in terms of a budget, and to pay no attention to the most radical transformation in the way materials and manufacturing and, for example, food. We haven't even talked about that yet.
And we
may have a chance. This is some of the most radical transformations in all of human history going on around us.
Right.
You know, and if you assume that the economy is going to be pretty much the same now in the year 2070 and you're making long-range Social Security, you know, calculations or long-range Pentagon budgeting calculations, for that matter, then you will. It's a total waste of time, for one thing. And I'm very opposed to these long-range calculations because I think the world is going to be so radically different, even in a couple of decades, that any long-term plans government make now will just be washed aside by events.
Well, you and I have no disagreement there. We found ourselves on the same side of the table on more than one occasion on that kind of argument.
Yeah,
I think that's right. I think the problem is it's while you and Jim Pinkerton and people with enormous imaginations and a lot of information can envision something that's totally different, you can't quite persuade people that it's going to be totally different. And even if you know it's going to be totally different, you don't know. I mean, your scenario is not going to be the exact right scenario. You know what I mean? I mean, it may be jetpacks, it may be something. You know, I always think about, like how different our life would be, how different the world would be if battery technology would just kept pace with microprocessor technology. You know, you'd have a whole different, we wouldn't be talking about hybrid cars. We'd have moved completely to electrical cars and things like that. Little things can make a big difference in what that scenario is going to be.
Well, this,
so if
this
you
affects,
can't actually predict what the future is going to be, your natural, the default position is a kind of straight line projection from the present.
But see, this affects the left as well as the right. I mean, it affects the budget deficit hawks on the right, but it also has to affect the way you think about global warming, you know, which is a serious problem, and we have to take measures. But if the measures are premised on there being no technological changes, in the next century, then I think you have to be kind of cautious. You know, so it seems to me the rational thing to do is to focus on outputs, say CO2 emissions.
Right.
But it's not to mandate particular technological solutions that it may turn out, are very short-sighted or that get overtaken by events.
Right.
So, for example, you would want, let's say, to tax carbon emissions. That makes perfect sense. But then you just leave it to industry and to individual consumers, you know, how they devise some way to reduce their CO2 emissions.
Well, sure. But innovation isn't going to happen unless you structure something in the market that makes it profitable for somebody. And that will require a governmental intervention to make something profitable where otherwise everybody wants to be a free rider.
Well, also, at the risk of being the devil's advocate, I think after 20 years of the neoliberal consensus that everything should be done by markets instead of by regulation. Mm-hmm. You know, we actually got rid of most of the pollution in this country by regulation.
Right.
You know, we didn't create a market in sewage that companies could dump in the river.
Right.
We just outlawed it.
Right.
Well, every market, that might be the simplest way. Again, I realize I'm sounding like a Bolshevik today. Cut the fence, expand Social Security, outlaw pollution.
Right.
But it's simple, easy, and enforceable.
Right, right. Well, there's some pollution you can out. I mean, one of the logics to the market, the market logic is you know that politicians are not actually going to outlaw every bit of pollution. That is, they might start off there, but then, that coal company from their state starts begging, and before you know it, so many exceptions get created by the political process that you have nothing left, right? That was the old story of the tax code, The tax rate was too high. This is what the old tax reformers used to teach. You know, if the tax rate was too high, politicians would be kind of sympathetic to the idea that it was too high, and they'd cut a billion different deals
for
different players, which is how it happened.
Yeah.
But if you do like a cap and trade system, if you basically say here's our societal goal, it's just like the war. It's not a war on X. It's just get something under control that was out of control. And then you're essentially structuring a market. It's you're using regulation to create a market that doesn't exist otherwise. So it's not like a free market world. You're using that market, and then the people who are in the toughest position, the least able to actually reduce their pollution, are able to kind of buy that right to go more slowly in reducing their pollution, let's say, from people who are able to do it more quickly.
So you build something
through regulation that's probably more efficient than having it done through political wheeling and dealing.
I have no objection to that within industry. Yeah. But the thing about CO2 emissions is you have to distinguish between automobiles and power plants, essentially coal power plants.
Right.
And it seems to me that it is such an enormous imposition, such a cost, particularly to working class people in the U.S. and other industrial countries, that you should go after the cars last. See, this sort of goes against conventional wisdom, that you have this campaign against SUVs and you buy hybrids and things like that. Seems to me the first thing you do is you cut off the CO2 emissions from the coal-powered plants, coal-fired power plants.
Right.
You know, and then over a long time, through probably fuel efficiency standards, you weed it out with the cars. But I do kind of worry that, you know, going after cars and even SUVs first, and then having the coal plants as an afterthought is kind of bass-ackwards.
Right. No, you definitely go after the coal plants first. But the coal plants are the political players, especially in the current system. I mean, especially under the current administration, I should say.
We'll divide and rule. Let's pit the SUV owners against the coal plant owners.
That's fine.
And the other thing about coal plants is their product is electricity, right?
Right.
And there are other ways of generating electricity than coal. You know, there's nuclear, there's geothermal, solar, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. There's also better ways to use coal.
But also because they're utilities,
then
governments can give rebates to consumers, and they can cushion the effect on working-class consumers. No one has ever explained to me how you could have a kind of a rebate or something that would cushion the effect of much higher gasoline taxes, for example, on working-class people. Maybe something could be devised, but I'm not.
Right.
It seems to me that going after electrical utilities that produce a lot of CO2, that would be the low-hanging fruit.
Oh, that's definitely the low-hanging fruit. And as far as the cars, I mean, we have a we're because of the way our because we gave up on anything related to energy conservation, almost 20 years ago, and as a result, we have an economy in which, for a lot of low-income people, the cars, both the way they get to work and the way they do their work, that kind of mobility is essentially the way we've structured a lot of our economy as well. We elites who, really spend well below the national average on gasoline for one reason or another.
Well, because we're living in expensive big cities.
Are not in a good position to judge it.
Yeah, we live in expensive big cities that the middle class and working class have been priced out.
So
it's easy for us to preach about being a pedestrian.
Exactly.
You know, if you live in a neighborhood like I do, in Adams Morgan, DuPont Circle, middle class, working class people can't afford to live here.
Absolutely not. Or they can't even live where I live, which is, up near the Maryland border. It's not.
Well, you can't even live where
I need to have a car, but I actually avoid. I don't use it. I don't have to use the car every day.
Right.
And I don't drive in anyway. So American politics. You want to talk about? We had a little thought about role of policy in these races.
Well, you told me on one of these previous shows you had ranted about. This is just a rant that I've been trying to get off my chest.
Well, rant, that's what it's for.
Which is, and it's not the usual rant against the presidential candidates having their own policies, which is that they will break them once they come into power.
Right.
That's the old rant.
Right.
You know, that Franklin Roosevelt ran on balancing the budget and Bush ran for a more modest foreign policy. Now, I've got the new rant.
Okay.
Which is the president is not a prime minister, right?
Right.
And he's not a dictator, or she's not a dictator.
Right.
So if Barack Obama or, Rudolph Giuliani or Hillary Clinton comes up with, this elaborate plan for everything that will be done in the next 8 years, well, thank God we have checks and balances.
Right.
And two branches of the legislature and, it's not going to... What is the assumption?
Right.
That upon being, even if you have a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president, that you're simply going to enact the platform of the candidate.
Right.
And the head of the senators and the congressmen have no say in it.
Right.
Absolutely. Right?
Right. So this is my rant. I give the same rant, particularly because, I worked on a presidential campaign in 2000 that devoted a lot of energy and took a lot of grief for producing a health care plan. And so, the only advice I give to any, it's free advice to any campaign who wants it, so far I've only seen one that's actually taken it, is don't produce a health care plan.
Yeah.
Because all you do is leave yourself open to all kinds of criticism. The fact is, if you become president, one, why would you just implement something that, four recent Harvard graduates cooked up in a bunch of all-nighters, as opposed to using the full intelligence of HHS, NIH, OMB, everything that's at your disposal when you're president? Not to mention, your biggest calculation is not, the thing you have to think about is not what's the ideal way to structure the cost reduction features of the reimbursement, blah, 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 it's what is the political circumstances you're facing and how do you get something, and you know, what are the limits of what you can do within those political circumstances? You
okay, Mark, you've worked on a presidential campaign, so you can maybe
right,
answer this question.
Not a successful one, so don't...
Well, you know, most of them aren't. Why do they continue doing it? I mean, who is the audience for this? The public doesn't pay attention to it.
Well, the press...
Is it the press? The press demands
that you
have a
position? Look at the Obama campaign, they have to stand up to this barrage of, you know, John Edwards has a health plan. You need to prove that you're serious and experienced by having a health care plan. Well, you know, I mean, the fact is that you're going to produce, you know, you may be more or less experienced. You're not going to produce, you're the candidate, you're not going to produce a health care plan anyway. You're either going to devote a bunch of resources of somebody else's time to doing it, or you're not. And it's probably not the most valuable use of time. But the press puts people through this hazing. The other candidates put people through this hazing. The amount of time we spend on in debates, and debates become, you know, the arguments about your plans to a large degree. So you sort, it sort of becomes a becomes an exercise. It's something you have to put up and deliver. Republicans do much less of it. I mean, they're able, and it's a Democratic vice. We all think, you know, you talk to any young person and they want to go work on a presidential campaign. Where do they want to work? They want to work in the issues shop. You got to work in the issues shop. That's where the serious people go. You don't want to be one of these hacks. Well, issues shop is not the most important place in a campaign, you know. The one thing I understood when I did work on a presidential campaign, which was Bradley's, and I'd worked for him on the Hill, was like, I don't want to be in the issues shop. I want to be, you know, closer to what the campaign is actually doing, which is communications and field organizing and things like that. But that's it's a Democratic vice. Like, you think that to be serious means you're about issues, and you know, to some extent it does. I mean, I'm a policy person. I'm not a attack ad maker or something like that. But you have to understand the whole picture of what your issues are fitting into and why you're doing them.
Well, I'm a wonk too, you know, but yeah. As a voter,
yeah,
you know, I want a chief magistrate.
Right.
I want a CEO,
right.
An executive who has proven that he or she can get people who are maybe smarter than he or she is, you know, than they happen to be, and put together a team and come to the right decision, and who will not hesitate when the whole world changes in 3 years
right.
to scrap everything and
right.
start over.
Right. Well, and not to mention, I mean, if the current administration didn't prove it, you know, proved anything, it was, you know, you elect somebody to deal with the problems you don't know about at the time of the election.
Yeah, and
not just the ones you do know about.
Right,
why the temperament is, it's perfectly legitimate to think about people's temperament and their attitude and how they make decisions and how they approach things. Maybe thinking about a plan is part of it. I'll tell you what I think is the theory. Here's the theory, I think, for a lot of Democrats also, and especially a lot of people that I know. It's a lot of it is about 1993. And even people, you know, who weren't involved in politics in 1993, and I was. I didn't work in the administration, but I was working on the Hill at the time. You know, there's certain things that happened in 1993 after Clinton took power that people tell stories now that are sort of like, if we could just change it's like playing with historical counterfactuals, you know. If we could just change that thing in 1993, we would have had a different outcome. We wouldn't have had the backlash in 1994, or health care would have been passed, or something like that. So one theory is, if Clinton had come in, if Clinton had had a health plan in his campaign, instead he kind of danced around. For a while he tried to not have one at all, and then he said he was for the pay-or-play option for employers, but he didn't have much with details. But if Clinton had been elected and he'd said right from the start, here's my health care plan. It's been my health care plan.
No, but you're getting away
you elected me. You elected this health care plan. He would have been able to push it through.
But you're getting
Who
away
knows?
From my...
Maybe that's true. Maybe that's not true. Obviously, they dithered for a long time. And by the time they came up with a health care plan, he no longer had the political capital that he would have had at the beginning.
But you're missing... Mark, you're missing the constitutional underpinnings to my rant.
Yeah.
Which is, the president is the chief executive. Not a one-person Congress.
No, I know.
We have
I know
a Congress
it's not my,
to come up with health care plans.
Of course it's not. But there are moments in our history, Reagan in 81, FDR, obviously there are moments when a president has been able to, you know, hold enough political capital, use a mandate, and get something done that Congress on its own would not get done. Right?
Granted that, but wouldn't it have been better, instead of having Iron Magaziner and Hillary in charge, to appoint the leading senators and congressmen?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And see what they come up with?
And I saw that happen, and you know what? You could see the roots of disaster.
You know, this was the theory.
Right. So my story about 1993 would be, instead of going in and worrying about what the best, ideal best plan is that Ira Magaziner and, you know, the highest IQs in the world are going to come up with, you actually get the politicians in the room and you deal with more, you know, you and I have talked about this a lot, you learn how to deal with Senator Moynihan better, and you bring the moderate Republicans into the room because, you know, those were good people, Senator Chafee, Senator Durenberger, and so forth. Those were good people. You bring them into the room, you figure out what's possible, you get them through. No question, that's right. The other story is the one that says that Clinton could have had a stronger mandate had he had a more detailed plan going in. I don't think that's right, but I understand why people are attracted to that story. And if that story leads them to say, you know, if John Edwards has this detailed and pretty good health care plan, if he sticks with it and if he's elected, it can take the form of a mandate for him. I think that what that misses is presidents who do operate from strong mandates actually build those. They don't build them in the campaign, as you say. They're not a prime minister. They build them in office, largely. I mean, Reagan built the mandate that he needed to put together the coalition that passed the budget and tax cuts. He built it largely after he was shot, and that sort of helped, that sort of boosted his popularity. And then he figured out, then there was a brilliant, you know, kind of figuring out of where you could begin to peel off the conservative Democrats, the boll weevils and so forth in that era. And then all of a sudden, this president who wasn't elected with a mandate has a mandate and is able to do this enormous stuff. And of course, they handled the congressional rules right and so forth as well. And I think you could say the same for FDR. I mean, I think you would say that, you know, a lot of his mandate began not as much with his election as with his inaugural and the language he used and the really quick action on certain things.
But FDR is a great example. He was opposed to Social Security at first. He came around. I think the ultimate negative example is Woodrow Wilson, because when he decided to go negotiate the Treaty of Versailles in person, he was advised to take along some congressmen and senators. So he didn't. So he had a brains trust. It really was like Ira Magaziner. You have the young Walter Lippmann, you know, and Colonel Edward House and so on. Right. Well, guess what? It's dead on arrival, you know, when it gets back to the Congress. Well, I want to segue to a related topic.
Okay, good.
Because I think this idea that the voters will vote for you if you have a detailed, wonky plan is morally corrupting to wonks.
Yes.
And this is what I mean. Because instead of writing your article for National Review or the New Republic or the American Prospect or the Weekly Standard or whatever, the Washington Monthly, saying, this is the best health care system for America, right? Or this is the best CO2 system for America.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been guilty of this myself. You're tempted to write, the Democrats can win in 08 if they adopt my incredibly elaborate plan which follows.
Right.
And so you keep up this pretense, and I think the editors do a disservice, you know, because, and the thing is, they think that's sexier, and they're probably right, you know, because these are partisan magazines, whether they're liberal or conservative, and it's all about winning, 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 but you have to package things that you think are just good for the country as something that will help the candidate win, and if, like me, you think most voters, you know, even if all of the presidential candidates adopted, you know, like my harebrained scheme for something, the voters would never know it.
Right.
They're voting because they like somebody's hair or, you know, somebody seems nice or they want to really kick ass or something like that.
Right. So you're doing it partly because you want to be in that position where you are the person. It's, in a sense, it's not so much your plan. By structuring it that way, you have the possibility of being the person who then, you know, becomes whatever you want to become in Washington.
Well, yeah, it's an advertisement for a job. But I just think the spin doctors and the wonks should keep in their separate spheres.
I think that's right, although there's a great value to people and you know who can do a little bit of both. But for the most part, I mean, somebody asked me the other day for advice about advising different campaigns and how much they should, and very much of a wonk, how much they should, you know, talk about the politics of a particular thing, even though they didn't feel expert on it. And I was like, well, that's pretty obvious, you know. Leave the politics. You know, it's like when you deal with a lawyer on some question, they wind up giving you sort of, you know, it's like I'm going to the lawyer for legal advice.
Right.
I'll figure out the other things. Same here, you know.
What about the politician?
Go to an economist for economic advice and let somebody else figure out what the political.
See, this is something I don't understand, because you're a wonk, and you're trying to sell your plan to a politician who, in most cases, repeatedly has been elected from his or her 20s or 30s onwards, right?
Right.
The politician has a better sense of what will sell with the public than you do, don't you?
Right.
You know, well, it seems like a sort of weird perversion of the semi-monastic calling of the policy wonk.
I think that is exactly right. I think the policy wonk should be the person who goes in and says, here's the right thing to do, sir.
Yeah.
And then there's somebody else. And that somebody else has to be able to understand the policy. You know, I mean, there is a sort of bridging function there if the person doesn't do it himself. Who says...
But there has to be somebody else who will say, we'll do this, only we will have no money for it.
Right, that's right.
And we will make it purely voluntary.
Right. Now, the problem is the people... Right, exactly. I mean, the people who do that, the people who parrot back, all too often, especially in democratic politics, bring, you know, I mean, their reaction is often, because for a whole bunch of cultural reasons, their reaction is always, you know, let's not go so far out on a limb on that. I mean, I remember trying to sell, you know, the presidential candidate who was the more liberal candidate in 2000 on taking the minimum wage to $7.15, you know, and I could not even, which is kind of where we're moving to now, 8 years later, but it was, you know, the level of caution. We can't really. That's too daring, and that's a political reaction, and it's a crazy one. It's an over. Wonk should push back,
right,
and be more daring and be aggressive about this is the right thing to do for a billion reasons. And I think what often happens is the wonks walk themselves back. The wonks aren't daring enough because they're trying to do the politics.
Right.
So a wonk needs to get in there and say, God damn it, the minimum wage needs to be $7.15 to keep, for, you know, whatever your argument is, to keep pace with inflation, to get people out of poverty, whatever.
This is something I don't understand, because according to my friends at fairvote.org, most politicians are fairly incumbents with fairly safe seats.
Right.
There are very few swing districts.
Right.
So I can understand if you just are teetering on the precipice why you would be ultra risk averse.
Right.
But why are all of these Democrats, or for that matter Republicans,
right,
with perfectly safe seats, let's just say the Democrats,
right,
what are they worried about?
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, make them minimum wage $9 an hour.
Right.
So then their margin of victory goes down from 90% to 85%.
Right.
Big deal. They lose a donor. Big
well,
deal.
A, they all want. They all think they're going to run for Senate, and B, they all actually think they're going to lose. And there's all kinds of reasons for that overcaution. I mean, I think the experience of the war, and the vote on the war resolution, has to have been a wake-up call, and I think for a lot of Democrats, it has been a wake-up call that you can pay a huge price for overcautiousness. Right, I mean, I think the calculation was always you pick your moments when you're going to be daring, and the rest of the time, you know, you play by the rules, and those moments are few and far between. And I think the war is a real reminder that there are prices on both sides, and that's I think going to change the culture a little bit. On top of which, I mean, politicians are very, very bad. It's just like what we were talking about at the beginning of this discussion about thinking about the future of the economy. Politicians are terrible about thinking about where attitudes and things are going to be 2 or 3 years from now.
Why is
that? So the idea, for example, you know, you had to be able to see that attitudes about gay marriage were going to move in a more tolerant direction, you know, but they could not, you know, very few people could see that when it came time to think to vote on things like the Defense of Marriage Act in the 90s, or attitudes about the war, frankly, that attitudes about the deficit should change. It's, you know, it's just very hard, even though they've been elected by measuring the exact moment they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And they get cautious about that, and often that last election in which they actually did serious work to get elected might have been a decade earlier. So they often can be very much out of touch with A, where things are right now, and B, where things could be in five or six years, which is what they ought to be thinking about.
Well, but there's no strategic entity. There's no long-range think tank with the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. I'm not talking about ideological, but I'm just talking about strategic.
That's right. That's
you know,
right.
Looking at demographic shifts in voting
right.
and things like
that's
that.
Right. That's right.
You know, and some of the European parties have, I don't know how much influence they have, you know, the Labour Party, Conservative Party, they have their own kind of in-house think tanks.
Right. Like the Fabians or whatever.
Yeah, it seems to me it would help.
Yeah.
I mean, you've written a lot about partisanship.
Right.
This isn't the traditional single-issue policy wonk think tank. And it's not, you know, the radical ideological one either. It would just be a sort of a strategic long-term unit.
Yeah.
Looking at what states you're likely to lose, which regions you might pick up, things like that.
Right. Something you put Rui Teixeira in charge of it.
He'd be good.
I think you could do something like that. It's also, I mean, the role of think tanks. You know, liberals have been obsessed with we need to have think tanks that play the role of those of think tanks like the Heritage Foundation. But they often create them. I mean, this is, I think, where the corruption of the wonk comes in sometimes. Like I was frustrated a couple of years ago when Center for American Progress, which is very much a Democratic oriented leaning think tank, obviously not a part of the party. You know, they came out with a tax plan that was actually quite undaring.
Yeah.
Which I thought was, that's kind of the tax plan you would come up with if you were a candidate.
Right.
But the role of a think tank is to come up with a tax plan that's much more forward-thinking. Now, they just came out with a poverty plan, which actually is great and is kind of forward-thinking and has a lot in it about why you need to think about poverty and economic opportunity and has some innovative ideas and stuff like that. So I think they're moving
into the think tank
tradition,
right.
knowing that hey, if politicians don't pick up all your ideas, that's not a problem. That's if they only take half of it, that's fine. The problem is if you pare it down to half, and then they take half of that, you know, you just have a very limited.
I agree. It makes no sense to have, you know, preemptive compromise against yourself.
Right.
You know, the right-wing think tanks will say, bomb Iraq and Iran.
Right.
And then the president can look like a moderate by just bombing
Iraq.
Exactly. Yeah, so, for example, let's get back to the minimum wage, or for that matter, the EITC, whatever.
Yeah.
The think tank should ask for much more than is politically feasible.
Right.
So that Congress
can... Or because they're not claimants on the process, they should make the substantive case for.
Make the case for.
Yeah.
I agree entirely about that. It just seems... there's a deeper problem with the Democratic think tanks. They were right that you needed this echo chamber, you know, this sort of media organization to match Fox and the Wall Street Journal and all of it. They're absolutely right about that. Because the liberals, you would have what were de facto liberal organs of opinion, but they would turn over half of their media to conservatives.
Right.
Whereas the conservatives were 100% conservative, so they end up with 75% of the media, including half the liberal media.
Right.
And the liberals end up with 25%. I have no problem with that. But they did it in the wrong staging. The sequence was wrong because the conservative movement battled out all of the ideas in the 50s and 60s before, you know, the Murdoch Empire and, you know, the Wall Street Journal and Bob Bartley and all of that stuff. So to start out with Air America, but there's no ideas there that everyone agrees on. There's no coherent post, you know, 90s ideology. That seemed to be a mistake.
Right. No, there's intellectual work that needs to be done in those periods of... when you don't hold power, and it's kind of a tragedy if you don't do that work. I mean, Republicans will talk. You might have been at this event a while back where Vin Weber was leading this group, and a bunch of us from New America were speaking to them. And I remember him saying to me, you know, the great time to be a Republican was 1977-78. You know, that's when we didn't waste our time on Capitol Hill or voting on. You know, we just like. I guess he was elected to Congress in maybe 76 or something like that. And, you know, we have formed all these study groups and we, you know, we just immerse ourselves in ideas. And, you know, it's really true. I mean, all the ideas that did fuel Reagan came out of that period.
But don't you think that the period, don't you think the Democrats and the liberals, progressives, whatever you want to call them, they kind of wasted 2001 to 2006?
Absolutely.
Because, you know, what they would do is they spent the whole time ridiculing George W. Bush personally.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Instead of just saying, look, he's going to be gone in 2009.
Right. Right. That's right.
We could
as a result, there are a set of conflicts, like the conflict about trade, the conflicts about deficit spending, taxes that I'm conscious of, and conflicts, I think, on foreign policy as well. They're conflicts that got buried by the unity in opposition, you know, or it's kind of like Yugoslavia under Tito. And those conflicts are going to come roaring out if a Democrat wins the presidency, and not enough work will have been done to figure something out. I think with trade, it's a particularly acute one because it's still a fight. You know, there's an anti-trade group that their view is like moratorium on trade agreements. Well, that's not answered anything. And then there's the old, you know, Rubenomics view, which is, you know, free trade and use education to lift people up. Well, that's not actually a view that's suited to the current economy. You know, that won't work the way it did in 1994.
Well, but why can't...
As a political answer. So there just hasn't... Not enough work has been done to figure out what's the new answer on trade, because we just buried the conflict under the fact that, well, we don't... Nobody likes any of the Bush administration trade deals, so, you know, none of the actual lines of conflict come out.
But see, this gets to another theme of mine, which is that parties and movements should be kept distinct.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is the country is divided into two parties because of our electoral system. You know, if we have proportional representation, we'd have three or four parties.
Right.
The successful parties are the ones that are actually coalitions of two or more parties.
Right.
You know, in the Eisenhower, in the McKinley era, it was the alliance of the Midwestern Republicans with the Northeastern bankers and manufacturers, and they constantly fought, except on election day they came together.
Right.
And then they fought between elections, but they were part of the majority.
Right.
So the one thing you don't want, it seems to me, if you want to be a successful party, you don't want to be like Tom DeLay and purge everyone and have this artificial unity through exclusion.
That's exactly right.
You want to simply agree to disagree about 85%, but then you pick your one or two or three issues, and trade may not be one of them, for example.
Right.
Where all Democrats, in the case of the Democrats, agree.
Right. And
then you have a free vote on everything else. And you have separate caucuses, separate magazines, separate
radio shows,
everything.
That's the point of a political party in this kind of system. It winds up being a coalition of very disparate views. And the problem that Democrats are going to face, you know, if and when they take full power, is that there's a whole cadre of people, and this is a lot of the blogosphere, and I'm generally the Netroots and stuff, which I'm generally, you know, super supportive of, but, you know, very supportive of. However, the model of successful politics that they grew up with is Tom DeLay's Republican Party. So their view is, we need this liberal movement, which doesn't even actually know quite what it stands for. We need this liberal movement to control the Democratic Party as completely as Tom DeLay's conservatism controlled the Republican Party. Never mind that that was a formula for the ultimately for disaster. And it's wrong. It's not the way parties work. On the one hand, I mean, I think they've built a lot more substance. They've given a lot more meaning to the Democratic Party than it had in the past. I think that's a good thing. I think parties are great. But I think it's based, you know, to the extent that it's tied to this one political model, it's very dangerous.
I think that's right. It's a formula for being a minority party in our system.
I think that's right. All right, we've been going for about an hour and 13 minutes, so we should probably wrap this up.
Okay.
We didn't talk about the British election or the French election.
Well, they'll still be there in a few
weeks. We also didn't give people the benefit of seeing a good Mark Schmidt, Mike Lind argument in action, which usually take place on email. So next time we have a good email argument, maybe we can make it available to the public.
Well, we just still have to be angry.
Yeah.
When we can get in front of the cameras.
Right, okay. All right.
So we just have to maintain our anger.
All right, I'll work up some anger about something. All right.
Okay, thanks.
Very good, Mike. Thanks.